Hello again. This is Josh Carr at The Real Angle, and today I'm speaking with David Wolf, managing partner at Skoloff and Wolf. David, how are you doing?
Hey, Josh, I'm well. How are you?
Good, 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 good. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for coming on.
Super happy to be here.
Good stuff, good stuff. So today we're going to talk about tax stuff, which I promise to our listeners is more fascinating than maybe saying tax stuff might lead them to believe. But let's start with the basics. So what do you do in history of the firm? And let's get into that stuff to get us started here.
Well, great. For those of the listeners who have not yet disconnected when they heard tax.
Yeah.
No, look, what we do is a very narrow area of tax, right? Which obviously relates to your listeners, right? We are focused on state and local property tax, but for real estate owners and operators, it is primarily your largest expense. So we focus on the bottom half, right, of your balance sheet as a property owner and developer. And what we do is we help property owners understand what their taxes will be, and then we make a living contesting those taxes. And that's, you know, we also provide other services, right, which we will get into as we go along. But that's the primary services that we provide. And I'm happy to talk to you a little bit about the firm and all that kind of stuff to give you a little bit of a background.
Well, yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, let's do a little bit of background. How long have you been doing tax law and running your own practice?
So it's kind of frightening. I was in a meeting recently and a good client of mine, a publicly traded company, says to the other side, I've been working with David for 20 years.
Right. And you're like, oh my God.
And I'm like, no, there's no way. There's literally no way.
Right.
And I thought about, no, it's true. So I've been doing property tax work for a little over 20 years.
There we go.
Started my practice initially at Davis Polk & Wardwell, which is, you know, large New York City firm,
right.
But always knew that I was going to, potentially leave, you know, and end up here in New Jersey. And I manage the firm that my father founded, and I manage it together with my identical twin brother.
Which is fantastic. And that's always good, keeping it in the family. And I will say law is one of the few fields left. I think it's like law and medicine where you see it like, you know, I do law and my father did it and his father before him. You do still have that.
It is a genetic illness. Yes, Josh.
It's inherited. It's like being albino or something. Sure. It passes through the bloodline.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, it's look, I mean, there's a reason why I think your field, they often talk about it being a calling, a vocation. It's not necessarily the economically rational thing to do necessarily.
Look, I think it's something that we grew up with, and we saw the passion that our father had for the practice of law, his colleagues had for it. And we saw that it was something that was very attractive both to myself, to my brother.
Clearly.
And it was something that we wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, now apparently over 20 years later, I get to do a podcast with you.
Hey, there we go. So let's talk a little bit about tax. I mean, look, as an owner, tax is always seems like something of a black box. I mean, you know, the broker says the taxes on the building are $100,000. And then, you know, we being a bunch of primitives start the conversation by just saying, great, let's grow it with inflation, you know, but then of course you get more into the conversation and you talk about assessments and what have you. Let's talk about the assessment process a little bit. First off, just how assessments work, like how states go about the job of assessing stuff.
So it's so interesting, and I think that's where I frequently come into the conversation is where you started, which is a potential transaction, and a prospective buyer talks to the broker, and they want to get an understanding of what the taxes will be, and a broker may be a little more optimistic than, or maybe not potentially as informed about a particular market, and that's when we get involved. Right, I have a very large practice in terms of property tax projections and due diligence, where we're writing opinion letters for investment committees of some of the largest institutions to help them understand what the taxes will be upon acquisition.
Sure.
Right. So, and we do this across the country. So there are certain issues that you need to look at in every jurisdiction. Now, when you ask me, David, what are, you know, tell me generally about property tax assessment, one thing to remember is that this is state law. So unlike federal law, where there is an answer, or sometimes it's an answer that I don't understand as a state guy, but right, these are 50 different answers, 50 different regulatory schemes.
Right.
And within those 50 different states, you can have local rule. Like where I'm sitting today, you have New Jersey with over 500 municipalities, all of which do things differently. But right, you're starting with 50 different state law. That said, there are some generalities that I think are important to discuss, and we can certainly discuss with how kind of assessments work and appeal and things like that.
Well, yeah, and just to talk a little bit about the assessment process just in general. I mean, I think first off, you know, when you talk about where assessments will go, I guess the challenge I've always had as an owner is, you know, from what I can tell, municipalities do not have, it varies when they first off just even get around to assessing. You know, right, some municipalities are on top of it, and some, from what I can tell, they get around to it when there's a neighborhood going through a lot of gentrification, and then they say, gee, we should probably pay attention to this because it's now a hot area, so we should do something, you know? So in my experience as an owner who often buys stuff in areas that may be marginal neighborhoods, there's no attention for years, and then as soon as there's a cool restaurant that opens up, magically everything gets reassessed. You know, which doesn't seem fair, for lack of a better word, but, you know, I guess they just kind of do it when they feel like doing it. Well, that's what I can tell.
The one thing that we should, and I'm sure we'll get into later, is when they only reassess new owners, that is unconstitutional. And that is something that we work on frequently. But in terms of overall municipal wide or county wide or statewide revaluation or reassessment, right, they're different. Some states are on cycles. Some counties are on cycles. New York City, for example, the annual reassessing every year, right? A new number comes out, boom, right? You can test it, right? You get a reduction, you get your refund, yes or no. There are other places, your jurisdictions in New Jersey, where they've gone 40 years without doing a reval, right? You have Connecticut, where it's every 5 years and it's periodic and it just rolls over and rolls over and rolls over. An right, important first question when you're looking at a place to buy is, when was the last reval? When is the next? Do we know when the next reval is?
Right. And not to put you out of a job here, but some of that stuff I, as an owner, can do on my own without an attorney.
Oh,
I
mean, please, if you, you don't need to call me for that.
Right. Like, I can call the assessor's office and just be like, hey.
Yeah. My general advice is, don't always just call the assessor's office, right? Because I'm looking at 20 Main Street.
I know. Sure.
But there's a tremendous amount of information online.
Right.
Right. And you can also call a county board of taxation. Right, call more of an administrative body and say, is there a planned revaluation in that local jurisdiction?
Right.
Rather than calling and alerting a municipal, like the assessor, about a property that's
right. So you can get the information without actually calling the guy who's directly right. You can sort of work around it, so to speak.
Exactly. But if you're my client, you can call me. I'll tell you.
Right. Because assumedly,
you're allowed to call me.
Right. That goes
anytime you want. But so that is a perfect first question, right? Is there a revaluation coming? Because you need to know that. You cannot buy a property with the expectation of stability and walk into a revaluation, right?
Yeah, and I hate to say it, but, you know, I, as an owner, I definitely learned the hard way earlier on in my career that this sort of stuff can jump out at you. And frankly, when I've talked to brokers about what they're selling, you know, look, they don't know. I mean, it's not, I don't want to say it's not their job, because arguably they should know everything because, you know, they're the broker and whatever, but it's not their job. I mean, they can, and the reality is, if you say to them, what do you think? They're going to say, well, this is what I know for a fact they're paying right now. And everything after that, you know, shrug. Like, I can't predict the future, you know, which I get. But then that's why we have guys like you to actually do a little bit of prediction, if you will.
Agreed. My view is, most brokers, if they know of a reval, they're going to tell you.
Sure.
Right? They want to do repeat business for the most part, right? They want to do the right thing by both buyer and seller.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they actually will know. And that doesn't, right? They're not property tax attorneys.
Right.
Right. We provide counsel and serve as a resource to many of the capital market brokers out there. Right. So there many brokers know, hey, this isn't my area of expertise. So if I'm marketing a deal in this market or this capital market type transaction, right, I'm going to send it to Dave. It's go off and off. Right. So, right. Brokers should, you know, potentially do that. And you as a sophisticated owner operator, et cetera, you know, should check in with somebody on those types of issues. But my view on brokers is they can make an error, but for the most part, just like they're bad actors in any industry, I don't ascribe typical bad motivation to the brokers.
What's also interesting about sort of, you know, tax certiorari work, to use that word, to which you want to define tax certiorari is what? You define it, not me.
So tax certiorari is really a New York focused word.
Okay.
So tax certiorari, for everyone else in the country, we just call tax appeals. So that is when you file either administrative action or lawsuit to contest the assessment on your property, you file a lawsuit basically says the assessment on my property, the value of my property is too high. I want to lower it and therefore reduce my taxes. What you're contesting technically is the value of the property. You're not directly contesting the taxes. Now, no one would do it unless the benefit was that you would reduce your taxes. No one's doing it just for the exercise of lowering your assessment.
No one wants to pay more money, sure. So, because the tax rate is the tax rate. Like, that's set. That's not a negotiation. So then really all you're doing is contesting the assessment, which that times the tax rate. A little bit of math gets you to your taxes.
A little bit of math.
What's interesting to me, too, is, you know, when you talk about what your window is to challenge it. Like, I know that varies state by state. You want to talk about that a little bit? Like, say, New York versus New Jersey, whatever, just to give an example.
Sure. So, like, for example, New York City would be a March 1. New Jersey would be an April 1st. If there's a revaluation, it would be a May 1st. There are places in Pennsylvania that will be in August. Right.
And that's all I'm trying to say.
Right. So just as illustrative, the key for any jurisdiction will be what is the deadline? Because the one thing that you can be sure of is that the deadline will be enforced. And if you sleep on your rights, no one's going to say, oh, you didn't know the deadline. We're going to let you in.
Right, and
what you're going to lose is the entire year's worth of potential relief.
Right.
Right.
And that's the thing. I mean, like, there's, you know, what I find interesting is, like, there's a lot of places where there's room for negotiation. You know, there's a lot of stuff where, you know, maybe you get served of papers, but, like, there's a fight about, you know, how many days it was, or, like, we didn't get a copy of the service, or it was improper and blah, blah, blah. But, like, this is really a thing where when the deadline is X date, it's like, no, it's X date.
And it's so hard. It can be so hard. So I teach a class every year on how to do this.
Sure.
And there's the classic case was a lawyer sending messenger service off to Bergen County, New Jersey, the day the deadline was due.
Right.
And he got to the County Board of Taxation with over 50 appeals the day it was due.
Sure.
And he was 7 minutes late. And the security guard was there and he's saying, sorry, I will not take it. I'm not going to take your appeal.
Right. Office and closed.
And the appellate division agreed. They said they're too late. 7 minutes is you're out of luck. And all those people lost their right to appeal that year.
Yeah. Deadlines are deadlines.
Deadlines. You're late.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. Cause like, again, in there's so much as someone who's, you know, unfortunately been involved in litigation cause life sometimes brings you that there's a lot of fuzziness and a lot of judge discretion, but this is one place where there just isn't.
Know your deadline for sure.
Yeah. So you go in on a tax appeal, and generally, what's the process? Like, Are you talking to the assessment office first? Like, how does, what's your workflow? If you
sure. So in many jurisdictions, in many states, you have both an administrative process and then a more formal court. Okay. So like, for example, in New Jersey, there's the county boards of taxation and a more formal state tax court. And the same thing happens, like, for example, it's many states. You'll have both an administrative level and then a formal court if you don't like the resolution. For example, in Florida, I may be heading down next week to a hearing at the administrative level in Florida. And if we don't like the result at that level, which then is the value adjustment board, then we would go up to a more formal court. Now, my view on everything is that you try to reach an early resolution through negotiation and settlement. And just like any litigation, a vast number of these cases settle.
Sure.
And there is a benefit to municipalities and to the taxpayer to early resolution, right? If you as a taxpayer can get your taxes down now, there's a significant value to that, both, right, in terms of cash flow and predictability and certainty.
And because once it becomes a lawsuit, you could be, it's not months, it could be years.
Oh, I mean,
you could
be fighting. So the average tax appeal in New Jersey could be 2 to 3 years. I've heard cases for 5 years. The longest case I know of was in this office and it was over 25 years. It was the General Motors case versus the Linden that went to the Supreme Court. They had of the United States. They had stopped making cars for like 20 years in New Jersey by the time that case was decided.
Wow. Yeah. I love stuff like that, because once it gets that far out, you know, the original parties who started it, you know, the principal attorney might have retired by that point. I mean, like it just stuff goes forever. That's insane.
I mean, they had stopped. I don't think they had made cars in like 10 to 15 years.
Right. But they're still fighting about this damn thing. Yeah. Right. No, it's and that's why I was hitting on that point. Like, yeah. So I imagine the settlement process is basically you're coming in with what, an appraisal? Like what's that look like, the administrative?
What I would say is, before you even get to settlement, one important thing to know about challenging assessments is what amazes me is that even sophisticated people in our business don't understand their assessments.
Okay.
So, and I'm going to get a little wonky.
Go ahead, please.
But assessment, most jurisdictions don't always assess at 100% of value. So
that I knew. Yeah.
Right. So depending on where you are, for example, you could be assessed 1 year at 100% of value, right? So in the year of a reval, let's say, you get assessed at 100% of value.
Yeah.
Like in a jurisdiction in New Jersey. That's great. But if you haven't been reassessed in 40 years, that assessment may only represent a fraction of value. So if you don't understand what your assessment means, you don't know whether or not you should contest it. Now, you should ask me and I'll tell you.
Right.
But you need to understand your assessment in order to challenge it. If you're in a jurisdiction that assesses at 70% of value, you may look at it and say, oh, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Right.
Right.
But
not understanding.
You don't realize that your assessment is a discount. So
I want to ask just a dumb question, which is why, to me, as just a layperson, the obvious thing to do would just be assess everything at 100% of value, because why wouldn't you? Why would one jurisdiction be like, well, this is 45% or 70%? Like, why would they even do that?
So I have no idea why a jurisdiction that assesses annually wouldn't put everyone in at 100%.
It
blows my mind.
Okay.
All it does is give people a view that they're being assessed lower and insulates municipalities from appeals, right? Which is a benefit to the municipality.
Right. I feel better about it because it's a lower percentage.
And maybe you won't appeal, right?
I got
a phone call early in my career from someone in Jersey City saying, I'm trying to sell my property. My broker wants me to appeal it, but it's only assessed for $5 million.
Right.
I'm like, well, what are you trying to sell it for? He said, 10. I said, but you're paying taxes as though it's worth $40 million. Because it's only assessed for like, you know, 8, T or whatever, 15% of value.
Right. Yeah, no, I get you.
But you know, in New Jersey or in jurisdictions that don't assess annually, if the assessment gets set, and then it just stays there, they're never going to be assessing at 100% of value because the assessment doesn't change and value obviously changes. So in those jurisdictions, you need to find out, well, what is the ratio? Otherwise, you're just in the dark. And it's not like the jurisdiction is going to tell you.
Right. So you figure out where your assessment is one way or another. You figure out some of this math. And then you're sitting down with someone, or I should say you, is sitting down with the administrative people to say, basically, hey, we're assessed at X. And based on cash flow, based on comparable sales, what's driving that conversation?
So for income-producing property, which is primarily what we work with.
Right.
The income approach to value is going to be the primary driver of resolution and the avenue that we and the basis for dialogue on almost all of these things. Now, jurisdiction to jurisdiction will vary. Some places will want to talk about sales. Or I think I mentioned to you previously, Hawaii is going to want to talk about the cost approach, which makes no sense, but that's what their law is. But most jurisdictions will want to look at an income approach to value.
Sure.
And because our law is somewhat antiquated, there are many jurisdictions where we will only use a one-year income approach, a capitalization approach to value. So we will not use a discounted cash flow, which I'm sure you've had other podcasts.
Yeah, you're not looking over the hold period. You're just saying right now what's going on.
We're saying what is the income stream now? We'll stabilize some stuff, right, depending on – we could talk about the difference between leased fee states and fee simple states, and that gets a little tricky.
Sure.
Right now what we're talking about is what is the income and putting a cap rate on it.
So what do you do with something like COVID, where obviously a lot of rents got whacked hard and people just frankly weren't making as much money as they thought they would?
So most states will look at things on a stabilized basis. So they will look at something like COVID and say, well, the fact that you're not collecting rent.
Right. This is clearly temporary.
We don't care. Right. The argument on the other side was, well, for example, in the hospitality industry at the time, although it's come roaring back, our arguments were, no, this is a new normal, right? If the argument can be that this is the new stabilized into the future. And if you go back and you look at the articles from the time, it was business travel will never come back. People will never want to travel again.
Sure.
And so we got 40 and 50% reductions in hotels around that time. But on cases today, because you can now, every year you litigate based on a valuation date.
Where you are now. Sure.
Where you are today. But for example, if you know, you look at, well, what are the cap rates for that particular year? What are the expectations with respect to income for that particular year? If you go back to COVID, well, what were the expectations for that particular industry for that particular year? But, you know, that's... So we look more at long-term trends than at short-term disruptions. I think this concept of paying stabilized is one of the biggest challenges that I have with clients. And depending on the state, more and more states stick to this from a rigorous perspective. So if you come to me with a vacant office building and you say, Dave, and I settled a case like this today. Dave, I am closing for $19 million on an office building that's 100% vacant. That's great. It's currently, you know, the last owner paid $72 million for it. Well, that sounds like you're getting a great deal, but it's now 100% vacant.
Sure.
Okay. I wish you the best of luck. Well, can you get it assessed for $19 million? No, I can't, because you're not buying it stabilized. The only thing that we litigate is what will the value be if you had a theoretical tenant in there, and what would the value of that income stream be?
Right. So then the argument turns to, well, what's current rents for the product?
Exactly.
It's lower, and then we can have a fight about that and what stabilized expenses should be. And to a certain extent, it all just becomes, from my point of view, magic. Because now we're arguing about, you know, my opinion of rents versus your opinion of rents and that sort of stuff.
I like to consider myself a magician. Yes,
there you
thank
go.
You.
No, and, yeah. And that's fine. But, I mean, there's a negotiation which takes place.
It is. But you can imagine how frustrating it is for an operator of an empty sure. office building or an empty retail center for me to tell them they have to pay on phantom tenancy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, right? yeah. Now, and as an owner, that strikes me as madness. But at the same time, I can take that hat off and I can understand the argument the other way, which is to say, look, we're looking for smooth. If you're the municipality, you want smooth cash flows. You want to get it. You want to know what your budget is. You want to know how much money you have coming in, and you want a nice smooth number that you can use to pay for stuff.
You do. And what the law essentially is developed to say is, look, we're not going to assess things based on the individual success or failure of an individual building.
Right.
And so we're going to provide, every building is going to get the market oriented level of occupancy.
Right.
So that if the office market is at 25% and that's the stabilized outlook for the building or retail, then that's what you're going to get, even if you're 100% vacant. And is this going to make the people who are 100% vacant crazy? Yeah. For the people that are 100% occupied, though, they're still going to get 20% vacancy. And those people are typically don't complain to me.
Yeah, you know, I hear you. What I find interesting about this, not to get into the weeds, but when we talk about the negotiation process and what you're doing on your side, you know, it's, you know, it kind of works, you know, frankly, what you guys do as a pricing model. I mean, you're a contingency-based firm because that's what generally I've seen in tax appeal, which kind of really gets to the heart of the matter, which is, look, are you going to save me money or are you not going to save me money? And since you get compensated based on saving me money, we're all generally moving in the same direction.
Yeah.
You know, if I win, you win, vice versa. You know, it moves along. It's a very different kind of litigation than other kinds of litigation I've been involved in, where you're, you know, paying attorneys by the hour and this sort of thing. It's a very different process.
It's exactly right, and it's almost exclusively contingency, and it's very much a partnership, right? We're invested in a positive outcome, all of us, right? We don't get paid unless, right, like
the law is
successful, and we're obviously motivated to get the maximum possible recovery. And it's, look, I love it. It's an exciting, engaging type of work. And unlike lawyers who don't have, and it's not that my clients are institutional. When I say the word institutional, I mean repeat, right? I do have institutional clients. I have private clients, institutional clients. But what I mean is I have clients of the firm who I get to build relationships with for decades, right? As opposed to attorneys who work with, I handle this case for this client and then they're gone.
Which is the way a lot of attorneys work. Yeah. I mean, if you're handling personal injury type stuff, assumingly you only get into so many car accidents in your life. So after you're done.
Exactly. And we have 15 matrimonial lawyers, right? So we have 15 divorce lawyers, and that's my brother's practice. And for the most part,
not know that, but that's a whole different line of crazy. So, yeah. No, that's,
for the
that's...
most part, people only get divorced once, although our record holder is 5.
Fantastic. And they used your firm all 5 times.
God bless them. Yes.
That's great. That's a very kind of strange repeat business.
You can't count on that repeat business.
Yeah, at a certain point, you should just date. Just stop.
Yeah. No, that's a different podcast for John's side of the press.
I'm sure he has crazy stories, which brings me to one question I always like to ask, which is surprises along the way. Any interesting surprises you've had lately or over your career that you feel like sharing? Crazy stories, anything like that? I always like to ask.
Yeah, look.
Good or bad?
It's hard to put in words, you know, the crazy tax story, but I will share a couple, I think, or, you know, that have happened recently in Hudson County.
Okay.
Where when you as an operator are living your life and you're happy When you receive a tax bill out of the blue for taxes for a couple of years ago, it's a freaking disaster, right? Sure. So last year, we had clients receive back tax bills for years, for tax years 2021 and 2022, or 2020 and 2021. For properties that they had never developed, but for which they had gotten approvals.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay. So they get the approvals to build, and then...
They got the approvals to build.
Okay.
And boom, 2 years later, or some instances even more, someone was 10 years later, but the town, the municipality, tried to go back and give them 2 years worth of back taxes, which they were not budgeted for, not expecting.
But how can they even do that, just practically? I mean, you send out a tax bill every year. Once the tax bill's out, the tax bill's out. Like, you billed me, and it's my tax.
So in October, in New Jersey, there's a process called the added or omitted assessment. And this municipality said, look, these are omitted. We forgot.
Okay,
we didn't do it.
Sure.
And we want to rectify the omitted assessments.
Okay.
And they sent out hundreds of millions of assessments.
Amazing. Amazing.
And this is not, I'm thinking about things not going well from my client's perspective, right? And surprises from my client's perspective in the tax world. Fortunately, in terms of a positive outcome, we did get all of those canceled this year.
Cool.
Because those are totally not appropriate.
Right.
Right?
Not a technical snafu where they forgot to mail the bill. This is, they just, I
get it. The statute for those types of omissions did not envision for approvals, but were that for land that actually had been assessed.
Right.
It's really for, you forgot to ever assess the property. Not
sure, I just missed a parcel, and here's the bill for the parcel I just flat out missed.
Right, gosh, I forgot to assess a couple of your buildings.
Yeah.
Not I assessed them wrong.
Right.
Right.
Just simply I didn't assess them.
Right.
And which does happen. I mean, there are some parcels which, people screw things up. They're not perfect. They're not perfect.
But in that vein, there are surprises in my business. And, this year's new surprises are I've got people's pilots being canceled. And, we talk about payments in lieu of taxes and abatements.
Right.
And there are... and that's an additional line of work that we do in terms of helping people get pilots and negotiating pilots. But when you underwrite a deal and you are expecting in the first 5 years of operation for your taxes to be phased in,
right.
Getting a letter that says you're not going to get any of the benefit is a huge problem.
You can blow up the whole deal. You can blow
Right. You blow up your entire return. So this year, one of the municipalities is sending out letters to taxpayers saying, you didn't complete construction within 3 years of getting the deal, and we've never enforced this before in the history of the city, but there's this provision that says you have to, so you're out.
Right. I gave you the tax abatement because you said you were going to do it and you didn't do it. So you don't get the abatement.
Right. So even though you did it, and even though there was COVID, and even though it was all this other stuff, we're canceling.
Right.
So needless to say, we're currently contesting those types of things. And
right. And this is why litigation exists. No, it's always fascinating to me. What can be haggled and what can't. And obviously when you get into things like COVID, a lot of what normal is gets thrown out. Because it just gets crazy. Yeah, no, COVID was fascinating for our market for many, many reasons. And the legal system did its best to adjust. And of course, it also brought us the joy of having hearings over Zoom, which still, for me, feels very weird, philosophically weird.
I mean, I wouldn't have known how to do this, but for COVID.
I know. It's off topic, but I mean, I think the thing I found fascinating about Zoom hearings was not Zoom hearings for matters like what we're talking about, but the fact that you had Zoom hearings for things like criminal cases, where people are actually going to be sent to jail. And I'm like, really? Like, it just seems like a, It seems like a very informal medium for things that result in like people being imprisoned.
Right. Or if they need interpreters.
The whole thing. Like,
or how about if I'm supposed to cross-examine someone, but I can't see whether or not they have someone in their room giving them.
Sure, giving them answers.
Right, helping them, right? Coordinating with them. Right, there are real issues associated with it. And like you said, this is a tax appeal. This isn't for someone's liberty.
Right. Win or lose, no one's going to prison over this stuff. This is just, we're just finding
out. We certainly hope not.
Yeah, yeah. Fingers crossed. Well, good. So a last question I always like to ask, and then, I'm glad we got to talk here. Plans for the firm. I mean, you've been running this. It's a family business. You guys, what's the vision? Grow the headcount, grow locations, keep on doing your thing.
Sure. You have
grander plans, if you will.
So John and I joined the firm almost 20 years ago, right? The firm was founded about 65 years ago by my father and godfather, great Gary Skoloff. And we've grown the firm from about 11 lawyers to 25, 26 lawyers. And that's a good size for us. I mean, the only way I see us growing would be to add a practice area that might be complementary.
Sure.
You know, we signed a lease recently here in beautiful Livingston, New Jersey.
Hey.
And we're happy with the size of the firm. And I do think continued national expansion of the real estate practice is something that I'm focused on. I think as the ownership of real estate has gotten more national,
sure.
It used to be that I owned New York real estate or I own New Jersey real estate. And now, obviously, with institutional ownership and just private ownership becoming more national,
yep,
we've responded more to that. I see that as a trend. But we're happy being a boutique firm. For our practices, we are very large in terms of what we do. So we have a very large property tax firm. We have a very large matrimonial practice.
Right.
But we don't need to be a very large firm.
Right. But yeah. But you're compared to some of the big names, you're small by headcount, but big in your practice, which is still at the end of the day. You know, look, I've hired attorneys for different things, and you almost always do better with a boutique firm who knows your specific issue. And then it's not about the size of the firm. It's just they just know how to deal with your issue. So
yeah,
that's good. It's good. Well, look, I'm glad we got to talk about tax appeals in general and the process. And talk a little bit about assessment and how it can be a bit of a jungle out there. So again, this is Josh Carr, Real Angle, talking to David Wolf about tax appeals and all that good stuff. And if someone wants to find you on the web, I'll just give the name of the firm, the web address, because if I don't do that, someone always asks. It's skoloffwolfe.com. And obviously, if you miss that, you could rewind, because that's the joy of the internet. Thanks again, David. Much appreciated.
Josh, thanks a lot.